Welcome to Hallel Fellowship, found on the internet at hallel.info. That's hallel.info. We hope you are encouraged by the following recorded Bible study to look deeper into every word that proceeds from the mouth of God and how they were lived out in the life of Yeshua HaMashiach, often called Jesus the Christ.
We are in the book of Genesis. We are in Lech Lecha, which is Genesis chapter 12. We all thought it was funny. It is your official
chapter. I went to him and repented.
Genesis chapter 12 through chapter 17 is the section we're coming to, Lech Lecha. Genesis 12. The Lord said to Abram, "Go for yourself from your land, from your relatives, from your father's house, to the land that I will show you, and I will make you a great nation. I will bless you and make your name great, and you shall be a blessing. I will bless those who bless you, and him who curses you I will curse. And all the families of the earth shall bless themselves by you." So Abram went as the Lord had spoken to him, and Lot went with him. Abram was 75 years old when he left Haran. Abram took his wife Sarai and Lot, his brother's son, and all their wealth that they had amassed, and the souls they had made in Haran. And they left to go to the land of Canaan. And they came to the land of Canaan. Abram passed into the land as far as the site of Shechem, and to the plain of Moreh. The Canaanite was then in the land. The Lord appeared to Abram and said, "To your offspring I will give this land." So he built an altar there to the Lord who appeared to him. From there he relocated to the mountain east of Bethel and pitched his tent, with Bethel on the west and Ai on the east. And he built there an altar to the Lord and invoked the Lord by name. Then Abram journeyed on, journeying steadily toward the south. There was a famine in the land, and Abram descended to Egypt to sojourn there. For the famine was very severe in the land. And it occurred, as he was about to enter Egypt, he said to his wife Sarai, "See now, I have known that you are a woman of beautiful appearance. And it shall occur, when the Egyptians will see you, they will say, 'This is his wife.' Then they will kill me, but you they will let live. Please say that you are my sister, that may go well with me for your sake, and I may live on account of you." But it occurred with Abram's coming into Egypt, the Egyptians saw the woman was very beautiful. When the officials of Pharaoh saw her, they lauded her for Pharaoh, and the woman was taken to Pharaoh's house. And he treated Abram well for her sake, and he acquired sheep and cattle and donkeys, slaves and maidservants, female donkeys and camels. The Lord afflicted Pharaoh along with his household with severe plagues because of the matter of Sarai, the wife of Abram. Pharaoh summoned Abram and said, "What is this you have done to me? Why did you not tell me she is your wife? Why did you say she is my sister, so I would take her as my wife? Now here is your wife, take her and go." So Pharaoh gave men orders concerning him, and they escorted him and his wife and all that was his. Chapter 13. So Abram went up from Egypt, with his wife and all that was his, and Lot with him to the south. Now Abram was very laden with livestock, silver, and gold. He proceeded on his journeys from the south to Bethel, the place where his tent had been at first, between Bethel and Ai, the site of the altar which he had erected there at first. And there Abram invoked the Lord by name. Also Lot, who was with him, Abram, had flocks, cattle, and tents, and the land could not support them dwelling together, for the possessions were abundant, and they were unable to dwell together. And there was quarreling between the herdsmen of Abram's livestock and the herdsmen of Lot's livestock, and the Canaanite and the Perizzite were then dwelling in the land. So Abram said to Lot, "Please, let there be no strife between me and you, between my herdsmen and your herdsmen, for we are kinsmen. Is not all the land before you? Please separate from me. If you go to left, I will go right. If you go right, I will go left." So Lot raised his eyes and saw the entire plain of the Jordan that was well watered everywhere. before the Lord destroyed Sodom and Gomorrah. Like the garden of the Lord, like the land of Egypt, going toward Zoar. So Lot chose for himself the whole plain of the Jordan, and Lot journeyed from the east. Thus they parted, one from his brother. Abram dwelled in the land of Canaan, while Lot dwelled in the cities of the plain, and pitched tents as far as Sodom. Now the people of Sodom were wicked and sinful toward the Lord exceedingly. The Lord said to Abram, after Lot had parted from him, raise now your eyes and look out from where you are, northward, southward, eastward, and westward. For all the land you see, to you I will give it, and to your descendants forever. I will make your offspring like the dust of the earth, so that if one can count the dust of the earth, then your offspring too can be counted. Arise, walk about the land through its length and breadth, for I will give it to you. And Abram moved his tent and came and dwelled in the plains of Mamre, which is in Hebron. He built there an altar to the Lord. 14. And it happened in the days of Aramphel, king of Shinar, Arioch, king of Elazar, Shadurlamar, king of Elam, Tidal, king of Goim, that these made war on Bera, king of Sodom, Bersha, king of Gomorrah, Shinav, king of Adma, Shimber, king of Zeboim, and the king of Bela, which is Zoar. All these had joined at the valley of Sidim, now the Salt Sea. 12 years they served Shiladamar, and they rebelled 13 years. In the 14th year, Shadulamar and the kings who were with him came and struck the Rephaim at Ashtaroth Karnaim, the Zuzim in Ham, Emim at Shibi Kirathim, and the Horites in the mountains of Seir, as far as the plain of Paran, which is by the desert. Then they turned back and came to In Mishpat, which is Kadesh. And they struck all the territory of the Amalekites, and also the Amorites who dwelled in Hazaron Tamar. And the king of Sodom went forth with the king of Gomorrah, the king of Adma, the king of Zeboim, the king of Bela, which is Zoar, and engaged them in battle in the valley of Sidim. Shadurlamar, king of Elam, Tidal, king of Goim, Aramphel, king of Shinar, Arioch, king of Elazar, 4 kings against 5. The valley of Sidim was full of bitumen wells. The king of Sodom and Gomorrah fled and fell into them, while the rest fled to a mountain. They seized all the wealth of Sodom and Gomorrah and all their food, and they departed. They captured Lot and his possessions, Abram's nephew, and they left, for he was residing in Sodom. Then there came the fugitive and told Abram, the Ivri, who dwelled in the plains of Mamre, the Amorite, the brother of Eshcol, the brother of Aner, these being Abram's allies. When Abram heard that his kinsman was taken captive, he armed his disciples who had been born in his house, 318, and he pursued them as far as Dan. And he with his servants deployed against them at night and struck them. He pursued them as far as Hobah, which is to the north of Damascus. He brought back all the possessions. He also brought back his kinsman, Lot, with his possessions, as well as the women and the people. The king of Sodom went out to meet him after his return from defeating Shadurlamar and the kings that were with him, the valley of Sheveh, which is the king's valley. But Melchizedek, king of Salem, brought out bread and wine. He was a priest of God the Most High. He blessed him, saying, blessed is Abram of God, the Most High, maker of heaven and earth. And blessed be God the Most High, who has delivered your foes into your hand. He gave him a tenth of everything. The king of Sodom said to Abram, give me the people and take the possessions for yourself. Abram said to the king of Sodom, I lift my hand to the Lord God the Most High, maker of heaven and earth, if so much as a thread to a shoe strap, or if I shall take from anything of yours, so you shall not say, it is I who made Abram rich. Far from me. Only what the young men have eaten, and the share of the men who accompanied me, Aner, Eshcol, and Mamre. They will take their portion. Chapter 15. After these events, the word of the Lord came to Abram in a vision, saying, "Fear not, Abram, I am a shield for you. Your reward is very great." And Abram said, "My Lord, what can you give me, seeing I go childless, and the steward of my house is the Damascene, Eliezer?" Then Abram said, "See, to me you have given no offspring, and see, my steward inherits me." Suddenly the word of the Lord came to him, saying, "That one will not inherit you. Only he that shall come forth from within you shall inherit you." He took him outside and said, "Gaze now toward the heavens, and count the stars if you are able to count them." He said to him, "So shall your offspring be." And he trusted in the Lord, and he reckoned to him as righteousness. He said to him, "I am the Lord who brought you out of Ur of Chasdim to give you this land to inherit it." He said, "My Lord, whereby shall I know that I am to inherit it?" He said to him, "Take to me 3 heifers, 3 goats, 3 rams, a turtle dove, and a young dove." He took all these to him, he cut them in the center and placed each piece opposite his counterpart. The birds, however, he did not cut up. Birds of prey descended upon the carcasses, and Abram drove them away. And it happened as the sun was about to set, a deep sleep fell upon Abram. And behold, a dread, great darkness fell upon him. And he said to Abram, "Know with certainty that your offspring shall be aliens in a land not their own. And they will serve them, and they will oppress them 400 years. But also the nation that they serve, I shall judge. And afterwards, they will leave with great wealth. As for you, you shall come to your ancestors in peace. You shall be buried at a good old age. And the fourth generation shall return here, for the iniquity of the Amorite shall not yet be fulfilled until then." So it happened, the sun set, it was very dark. Behold, there was a smoky furnace and a torch of fire which passed between the pieces. On that day, the Lord made a covenant with Abram, saying, "To your descendants I have given this land, from the river of Egypt, the great river, the Euphrates River, the Kenite, the Kenizzite, the Kadmonite, the Hittite, the Perizzite, the Rephaim, the Amorite, the Canaanite, the Girgashite, and the Jebusite." Chapter 16. Now Sarai, Abram's wife, had borne him no children. She had an Egyptian maidservant whose name was Hagar. And Sarai said to Abram, "See now, the Lord has restrained me from bearing. Consort now with my maidservant. Perhaps I will build up through her." And Abram heeded the voice of Sarai. So Sarai, Abram's wife, took Hagar the Egyptian, her maidservant, after 10 years of Abram's dwelling in the land of Canaan, and gave her to Abram, her husband, to him as a wife. He consorted with Hagar, and she conceived. And when she saw that she had conceived, her mistress was lowered in her esteem. So Sarai said to Abram, "The outrage against me is due to you. It was I who gave my maidservant to your bosom, and when she saw that she conceived, I became lowered in her esteem. The Lord judge between me and you." Abram said to Sarai, "Behold, your maidservant is in your hand. Do to her as you see fit." And Sarai dealt harshly with her, so she fled from her. An angel of the Lord found her by the spring of water in the desert, at the spring on the road to Shur. And he said, "Hagar, maidservant of Sarai, where have you come from and where are you going?" She said, "I am running away from Sarai, my mistress." The angel of the Lord said to her, "Return to your mistress. Submit yourself to her domination." An angel of the Lord said to her, "I will greatly increase your offspring, and they will not be counted for abundance." An angel of the Lord said to her, "Behold, you will conceive, and you will birth a son. You shall name him Ishmael. The Lord has heard your prayer. And he shall be a wild ass of a man. his hand against everyone, everyone's hand against him. Over all his brothers shall he dwell. And she called the name of the Lord who spoke to her, "You are the God of vision," she said. "Could I have seen even here after seeing?" Therefore, the well was called the well of the living one appearing to me. It is between Kadesh and Bereh. Hagar bore Abram a son, and Abram called the name of the son that Hagar bore to him Ishmael. And Abram was 86 years old when Hagar bore Ishmael to Abram. Chapter 17. When Abram was 99 years old, the Lord appeared to Abram and said to him, "I am El Shaddai, walk before me and be perfect. I will set my covenant between me and you, and I will increase you most exceedingly." Abram threw himself on his face, and God spoke with him, saying, "As for me, this is my covenant with you. You shall be a father of a multitude of nations. Your name shall no longer be called Abram, but your name shall be Abraham. For I have made you the father of a multitude of nations. I will make you most exceedingly fruitful, and make nations of you, and kings shall descend from you. I will ratify my covenant between me and you, and between your offspring after you, throughout the generations, as an everlasting covenant, to be a God to you and to your offspring after you. I will give to you and to your offspring after you the land of your sojourns, the whole of the land of Canaan, as an everlasting possession, and I shall be a God to them." God said to Abram, "And as for you, you shall keep my covenant, you and your offspring after you throughout your generations. This is my covenant which you shall keep between me and you and your offspring. Every male among you shall be circumcised. You shall circumcise the flesh of your foreskin, and that shall be the sign of the covenant between me and you. At the age of 8 days, every male among you shall be circumcised throughout your generations. He that is born of the household or purchased with money from any stranger who is not of your offspring, he that is born in your household or purchased with money, you shall surely be circumcised. Thus my covenant shall be in your flesh for an everlasting covenant. An uncircumcised male who will not circumcise the flesh of his foreskin, that soul shall be cut off from his people. He has invalidated my covenant." God said to Abraham, "As for Sarai your wife, do not call her name Sarai, for Sarah is her name. I will bless her. Indeed, I will give you a son through her. I will bless her, and she will give rise to nations. Kings of peoples will rise from her." And Abraham threw himself upon his face and laughed. He thought, "Shall a child be born to a 100-year-old man? And shall Sarah, a 90-year-old woman, give birth?" Abraham said to God, "Oh, that Ishmael might live before you." And God said, "Nonetheless, your wife Sarah will bear you a son. You shall call his name Isaac. And I will fulfill my covenant with him as an everlasting covenant for his offspring after him. For regarding Ishmael, I have heard you. I have blessed him. I will make him fruitful and will increase him most exceedingly. He will beget 12 princes, and I will make him into a great nation. But I will maintain my covenant through Isaac, whom Sarah will bear to you by this time next year." When he had finished speaking with him, God ascended from upon Abraham. And Abraham took his son Ishmael and all those servants born to his household and all those he had purchased for money, all the male members of Abraham's household, and he circumcised the flesh of their foreskin on that very day, as God had spoken with him. Abraham was 99 years old when he was circumcised on the flesh of his foreskin, and his son Ishmael was 13 years old when he was circumcised the flesh of his foreskin. On that very day, Abraham circumcised with Ishmael his son, and all the people of his household, born in his household and purchased for money from a stranger, were circumcised with him. Ouch. Yes.
Okay. Number one, I read in my commentary that Abraham was not circumcised when he had Ishmael, but he was when he had Isaac.
That'd be correct.
And then the commentary said that that meant that Isaac was born in holiness.
I read the same commentary. Rashi is actually the one who argued that.
Okay. Mm-hmm. It was a good thought.
Yeah.
Okay, now, every year when I go around my cycle, I don't understand what I'm supposed to learn from the War of the Kings.
Oh. The War of the Kings.
A bunch of names that you can't pronounce and places that no longer exist.
That's true. That's true. There's a twofold answer to that question, which we're going to get into a little bit. When you're looking at a Torah portion, or any portion for that matter, not a Torah, but it could be any part of the entire Bible, always think into your mind, because this is a standard thought process, there are two ways of life. There are always two ways of life. A choice A or a choice B. Choice one, choice two. Throughout our entire books, New Testament, Old, always have the same philosophy. There's two ways. There's God's way, there's man's way. Always focus on that. So any scenario, any story you get, think about, okay, is this person's story, is it God's way or is this man's way? And compare them. When you see that, most of the stories will reveal themselves why they're there. That includes the kings, they're fighting. The kings, the fighting the kings as far as who took what and who gets captured, yada, yada, yada. That part isn't the important part. It's the reaction of how the kings responded afterward. Where that comes in explains the story of the battle itself, which we'll get to that later. Any other questions or comments so far? Yes, Larry. Excuse me.
Where we were gone because of the fire and stuff like that, did we start before 12?
Or is that, did we start before 12?
What happened to the first?
Oh, yes. We're in the Torah portion of cycle, so it's fixed throughout a given year, regardless of where you are on planet Earth. So, for example, we may have had fires that was during Sukkot, and the following Shabbat after Sukkot is Torah portion chapter 1 through 6. That's Genesis 1 through 6. Well, if we lived in Nebraska, we would have been reading chapters 1 through 6 that particular day, that particular Saturday. But our congregation, because of a lot of reasons, evacuation and such, we said, we're not going to hold services that day because we were still being evacuated and problems were happening. We thought it was unwise. So that particular day wasn't continued on. A lot of road closures were still happening. So people couldn't physically get here. Yes, and actually we'll go through again, Genesis 1 through 6, and then last week, last Shabbat, we did Noah, the section, which is 6.5, halfway through 6, through chapter 11 was in the last Shabbat. Whose hand? Yes, David.
So just a couple of thoughts and a couple of questions. You know, I'd read this section several times before, and I was always, you know, kind of the whole, you know, Abram and being deceitful to Pharaoh.
Uh-huh.
You know, why didn't he trust in the Lord kind of thing, turned his wife over. And it just kind of came to me this time when we were reading it. It just seems to me that, you know, he understood that he was on a mission from God and whatever that took to survive and go forward. And then, you know, as you read through it, you see what actually took place. He left with many things.
Yes, he did.
So, and not only was Pharaoh cursed, but he was blessed through that whole process. And then, as we know, the story of Sarah and the child. And so, anyways, that was just a thought on that. But getting to a couple of questions that I had. One of them is probably, anyways, you know, it talks about several times where he built an altar.
Yes.
Doesn't describe what the altar is,
right,
or anything like that. And I'm curious if that has something to do with, you know, ancient covenant practices, or, you know, what is the significance of building an altar? Was there other places that this was done in that society? And as the father was now his king, that he was building an altar for him instead of, you know, so that's kind of a question on that. And then also the other thing is when it talks about Ishmael and that he's going to be blessed with a great nation and 12 princes and a great nation. And I'm just, I know we've probably looked at this before, but it hasn't stuck. So I'm wondering if you could just kind of address that again as to who were those descendants and where they talked about in the Bible? Where did they go? I mean, do we have any idea whom they are today? Blah, blah.
That's that descendancy thing is a big answer. So I don't know if I get to all of that today, but Ishmael's descendants are listed as far as his immediate sons and their grandsons are also listed as well. as well as they intermingle. Ishmael and his descendants intermingle with the rest of Abraham's descendants. Abraham didn't just have Ishmael and Isaac. After Sarah dies, which is like the next Torah portion, it discusses that Abraham remarries Keturah and has many children, many other children, and they become nations of themselves. They're so prosperous, and they all occupy, along with Esau, between Jacob and Esau. Esau occupies the same territory in the mountains of Seir in the Edom area. They all intermingle. They have their own nation, but they all take over large swaths of their own land in the same general region, all knowing they are descendants of Abraham. Hence, they dominate the Arabs. They dominate the entire region. Now, they are attacked and taken over as time goes on from other countries, but they still own their territory. They grew from there and become large nations. But they are all descendants of Abraham. They didn't vary too much. As opposed to, for example, the Babylonians or the Assyrians, which were also, we call Arab, is mixed multitude. Babylonians and Syrians are also there as well, and they were dominant for a long time. But they eventually lose their domination to Abraham's descendants, who actually end up dominating them over a long period of time. Yes, Larry.
Can't you say also that this is one of the first, I mean, I guess except for the previous chapters, where someone tried to help Yahweh get his thing done, and that has caused problems ever since, right?
Yeah, it's on purpose.
Esau,
yes.
and all the fighting that's going on in the Middle East stems from this.
A good percentage of it does. That is true. Yeah, you could argue this probably with the first ones that somebody tries to intervene on God's behalf to make his plan come forward. Let me help you along the way. And it caused severe problems, but it wasn't by accident. This is set up, and God wasn't unaware of what was happening. It was on purpose. Yes.
you didn't address the altar thing.
Oh, right, the altar. That's part of my lesson. I'll get to that later, the altar. Yes, Deborah.
This is all scratchy. Okay, I wanted to ask you about, it said, he heard, heeded to the voice of his wife. And so that, isn't necessarily a bad thing after the sin. You know what I mean? Because the two are one. And so
this is not a critique of Sarah.
No, I know. But I just wanted, I noticed that when you were talking.
Yes.
I mean, I heard that. And mm-hmm. a lot more. And then he asked about the 12 brothers. And then he was 86 years old when Ishmael was born. And so I wanted to just get a little bit more clear about that. And also that Abraham was called out of his country.
Yes.
To leave his family. Mm-hmm. So
yes.
Maybe that's something we may have to do, is leave our family in order to go with God's plan.
Yes. Yeah, in a manner of speaking, yes, it is a philosophy in life, a mental state, as well as a physical one. Some of us may require to physically leave, but some of us emotionally, spiritually left, though we have physically not changed. But our family, what we were taught or raised up with, say, you know what? That's a bunch of garbage. I know better than that. I'm dividing myself out of what is once, and throw the garbage out. Not say the loving kindness of a family out, but the garbage that you were taught out. So it's not too abnormal for us to relate to that concept. Any other comments, questions? Okay, that's fair enough. Let's jump. So, Genesis chapter 12. Jump back to chapter 12 as we began. Lech lecha, which means go for yourself. It's you go, which means it is for your benefit to go somewhere. To leave for your own benefit. This is not for God's benefit. This is for Abram's benefit. To leave your father's house. Now, Abram goes through a whole bunch of different tests and trials throughout his life. This is his first one. As Deborah pointed out, it's not so easy to leave your family. To leave what you were trained, taught. I mean, he's 75 years old when this event happens to him. Now, granted, I realize that they were in the process of moving or traveling. This little map up here indicates as far as the approximate route he would have likely taken. Now, this not that you can see the terribly well in the yellow lines, But starts Ur of the Chaldeans as a small little lake-like spot down here where the Euphrates and Tigris rivers join as they enter into the Gulf of the Arabian Gulf. It's in this spot which he travels up. This is the trade route that most of them would travel along. It's not a direct shot because who would travel across straight shot to Canaan? You'd all be dead. There's no water. It's hilly, it's sand, there's no grass, there's no nothing, it's water, it's this waterless desert area. So you have to travel along the river routes, which they travel up mostly in this particular route, go through the Euphrates River, up to Haram, which is up here in the northern area next to Assyrian territory, then travel back down into the land of Canaan. That is a route which almost everyone took, with virtually no exceptions, except unless there was a war going on and you were fleeing. That's still the route people would take because, again, crossing maybe a desert unless you have an airplane or a car, it's pretty awful. Hence, notice there's no cities in the Arabian desert right there. Because no one lives there. Even the Bedouins avoid that area. It's pretty awful. Anyhow, so that's the route he most likely took. It's a relatively wondrous route. It takes a number of months. I could be wrong on the exact timing, but I believe it's a 3-month time. It could be 4 months walking it. The whole route with the route. Now, when Abram sends his servant, so Abraham, his servant Eleazar back, he doesn't go all the way back to Ur. He goes all the way back up to Haran, which is about this far, about half the distance. It takes him a few weeks to get there in order to get to that that destination. So it's Abram's first test. It's a leaving his family. Oh, yes, Louise.
Okay, I'm very sorry. There's a place called Haran.
Yes, and there's a person called Haran.
Exactly, and it took me a long time to understand that. Boy, that one really confused me.
Yes, I believe, recall to the previous chapter, I could be wrong though, is Terah either established or dwelled the place of Haran. I think he's the one who named it after his dead son. I think that's what had happened. I could be wrong, but at least what had happened to him is that he named it there. That is their hometown. I don't know when Haran died. But he's Lot's dad, as far as when he died. But the timing of which Abram was leaving Ur the Chaldeans is right at the time which the Tower of Babel was happening. So Abram was still alive. He was in his, 30s or 40s. The Tower of Babel was being built. So it's not that far removed from him. And he was from that generalized area. He probably saw it. Didn't necessarily participate in it, but he probably saw it being built. Now, imagine for yourself for a moment, the Tower of Babel, all these various people, and they all instantly can't communicate with each other. Usually people divide and they fight to take. And so there's a good chance, not necessarily, but a good chance, most commentators argue, that during the Tower of Babel, when God divided the languages, a war broke out, in which people were scattered from that, not just from communication, but actually fighting amongst each other. I may want what the language over there people have taken. I'm going to go get it. And so I fight them for it. Haran, his brother, may have died at that time or from some ensuing process of there. I do not know. Yes.
Oh, well, I want to say is that I noticed this time, and of course we've studied these, the number of years, is that Lot took the well-watered green area. And when humbly Abram took the land that he took, it was probably more desert, hilly. And I thought, wow, that's awesome. Because, where there is plenty of water, plenty of food, plenty of wickedness, life is harder. But when you go out and you have a little less and a harder work, you're busy, you're tired at the end of the day. So I felt that is humility. And I thought that's a good thing. Yes. We don't always take the best of everything. It might be in our benefit to draw us closer. I thought that was so incredible. Seeing that, I was like, wow, God, at this time right now, feeling the way I am, thank you. I needed to see that, because I feel like that in my own family now is that, we all go through periods in the 100 years or whenever, all of that God is revealing and drawing us century after century, which I believe that he is, through all the generations until he's done, until the fulfillment of the Gentiles is in. I believe that every one of us goes through that experience. And if we choose to not always have that well watered, or maybe it was chosen for us and our eyes are open, we can say, wow, I am so glad I humbly have this old hoop-dee-bar, or I ain't got what I think I should have. You know, though I have one person who's had a lot of everything, but I share it. I hope. But I just wanted to say that.
That's actually one of the lessons we're talking about today, is that choice that Lot makes and how it affects and why that choice is made. How that affects each of us and our choices. It's not quite so obvious as far as initial size. We'll get there shortly. Let's see here. So, chapter 12 again. Back to chapter 12. It points out that, Abraham took all of his stuff, everything he had, that he traveled around and left his hometown. Again, a reiteration. Abraham's faith is what we're examining here. And what is Abraham's faith based on? How did he get righteous? Yeah. It's a combination of listening and doing. I believe we were on the way down here from home, we're discussing the parable that Messiah points out regarding this particular topic. Regarding this topic, he gave the example of the man, the house, the rock, house, the sand. And that was example for this Torah portion. And the reason it's pointed out is because if Abraham hears God and does nothing, he's a man who put his house on the sand. That was Messiah's example. To hear and not respond to the words, not actually do them, your house in the sand. You heard it. Hearing is easy. That's the easy part. The doing is the hard part. But one who hears and does is the one house of the rock. And of course, he explains the rains, the trials come, and everything falls apart. The actual doing is what matters, not just the hearing. Hearing is only part of it. Hearing is the easy stuff. We can hear the Torah all day long. That's great. I'll have to just sit down and open my ears. Doing it is a whole different problem. It's a lot more involved there. And that was Messiah's example. Now we have example of Abraham, precisely what he did. He heard it, but he did it. Yes.
Isn't there a difference between the motivation of doing something, like if you do something just to brag about it and say that, you know, well, I got to do it, versus doing something because you love it, because God wants you to? The loving it is, in my opinion, I would say, is being righteous, because if you do it out of the wrong motivations, I don't think God sees you as righteous that way.
If you look at God's instructions to Abraham, just what he told to do, they're not easy things. They're hard things to do. Most of us, I don't know about you, but me personally, I do. When things are easy, sure, I'll do that. That's not a problem. When these are hard, I usually avoid the hard ones, because hard ones is a lot of work. It's not so easy. The reward isn't that great. I'll procrastinate on the hard things. I'll do the easy ones first. Yes, the line leads to resistance. That's a great example. That's what we normally do. And when things are easy, get great glorification from it. It's a instant gratification. Again, that's easy, simple, something simple to do. We all do that. When the gratification is 10 years later, 20 years, a generation later, or many generations later, are we inclined to do it? No, we won't. Because I don't get the reward immediately. I get to see the results. In Abraham's case, he already had as an inheritance that city of Haran. That's part of his family's heritage. Is that city nothing? No, it's a huge city. It's a big town. Lots of people there. Lots of property. Lots of great living area. That's easy to do. However, what did he wind up doing? Let's go to a territory that once he gets there, there's a massive famine and you can't stay. Gets to Canaan. The land of Canaan, he gets there and there's a famine when he arrives. There's no food. What does he have to do? He has to go back into Egypt because there's no food there for the land that God said is yours. That's not such a good, easy choice. It's a territory that's hard to do. It's a hard choice to make. And most would say, God, are you sure this is the right choice? Did you make a mistake? You really want to bring me to a desert type of land where there's no food? I can't survive? God, are you there? Can you hear me? Are you hearing the words coming out of my mouth? Obviously, you made a mistake here. That's a hard choice. So when God directs us to be righteous or do something on his mind that is right versus what we choose is right, it's not such a simple, easy decision. His right is harder. Our right is easy. What we want to do is, oh yeah, that's the right thing because it makes it feel good. When God says, this is the right thing, it's like, I don't want to do that, it's a hard thing to do. It's too hard. Make sense? And Abraham's making that choice.
You know, after a long period of time,
It's a dichotomy in nature, be right or go wrong.
There is.
I'm seeing it more and more in my life, but, you know, different people in my family as an example of what not to do, you know.
Well, that's good. Our objective is to observe and watch people as well. That's how we learn. We learn how people react, how people live their lives, and say, okay, and it's called discernment. Yeah. Was this action and the result, was that correct, or did the results turn out incorrect? Results turn out poorly, most likely the action was wrong to start with. We could argue it was carried out poorly. No, generally, if the results are that bad, the action wasn't the right action. We may not understand what the right action was, but the action that did happen wasn't the right one, because the results turned out bad. God is interested in results at the end as well. As he points out to Abraham, you will live to ripe old age. Note, as we read this, your children could go into slavery for years and years and years, but they'll come back out again. So at the action of the route was hard, but at the end will turn out positively for them. Okay, let's keep going, because I don't want to take too much time on all this. Altars. So he goes, he gets to Shechem. What's the first thing he does? He builds an altar, as David asked, what's up with the altars? He builds an altar. First thing he builds in Shechem, I'm going to draw a zoom-in map here briefly. So Shechem, I'm just doing the small section where Abraham first hung out. He didn't hang out the entire territory. So if I have the Dead Sea, Israel's basic, I'm not drawing the top half of the map. Shechem's a small town about there. I and Bethel are nearby. They're not that far. South and north, could be wrong on that. South and north of Shechem. Where is Shechem? There it is. They are not listed in this map. Shechem, Bethel and I. There they are. They're just south. They're a little further south. They're close. A little further south. So Shechem, Bethel, and Ai. Ai and Bethel are straight across from where Jericho is. Remember Jericho and Joshua comes through and the walls come tumbling down. After that, the next valley they take out the territory of the town of Ai, which is Ai. And Bethel is this one. And this is Shechem. Ai and Bethel are very close where Jerusalem is, in the same generalized area. So he comes, he builds an altar in Shechem, because this is the land that God said, this is your land. So why is he build an altar? So thank God. What do you do with altars? The altar connects you with God. And that when you wish to give them to God, can we give God anything? No. I can throw things in the air as high as I want. They always come back down again. He doesn't keep them. So what do we give? We can't give him a physical object. We can praise him. We can say words. Yes, the burnt offering. That's where the altars come from. It's a burnt offering. That's the method which we give him something that is valuable to ourselves. Now, we value what? We value gold, we value silver, we value people, we value water, we value food. Now, you can heat gold all you want. It's going to take a long time for it to vaporize, turn into gas for God to accept it. That takes too long and you don't bother with it. Same with all other kind of metals. Water, of course, boils away. What thing that you can burn up and look like you're giving it? As if the thing, the large item was this big, and when it's all done, it's this big. Well, what happened to it? The idea is the contents that it went up in smoke. As we see all the houses around us went up in smoke, right? That's it, that it went up to heaven as a pleasing aroma. You don't burn things you don't want. You don't burn unholy objects, things that are unvaluable to you. You burn things that are valuable to you. That's how you give to God. What is worth something to me, I give it to him. So when he builds an altar in Shechem, it is praising or pointing to God. You gave me this land. I can't give you dirt and throw it back up at you saying thanks. I can't give you money, but I can give you what is valuable to me, the animal that I'm going to offer on this burnt offering to you. It's a method which we give from ground up to heaven. Now, the New Testament explains what is that altar, what is that animal. It's your praises, the words coming out of your mouth. How many of us value praises from another human being to us? We all do. That's a great value, isn't it? So they praise you. Wow, what a great job you're doing. What a great person you are. What a great blah, 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 blah. We love that. It lifts us up. It builds us up. That's a great valuable item. Now, if we give that same praise to God, what does it do for him? It makes him happy, lifts him up. So thank you. I did a good job. You're appreciating the work I've done. That's the nature of the altar, the giving up the animal, as well as the praising of your words to give up to God. It lifts him up too. Not physically, but spiritually. Lift up our offerings of God, you are great to him. That's a good thing. That's what, hence altars came from. Now, altars were used for pagan purposes for probably forever. They've always been going there. They still dig up altars that are hanging around in the area of Israel. Not Abraham's altars per se, but many other altars use the territory. They've dug up archaeology stuff of pagan altars everywhere. People use them for child sacrifice because it was a valuable item, as we discussed, the animals are valuable, but children are more valuable, so they burn the child up. Of course, it's abhorrent and evil, but that's a different part of the story. As well as other animals and things that are also people that people valued. And God also requires that he wants to value the item which you are offering to. Hence, pigs, he doesn't value them. Don't offer them. They are not set for him or given to him. But I want to focus your attention not so much on Shechem's altar, which is Abraham saying, God, thank you for getting me here. It's this one. The altar he puts between Bethel and Ai. That explains most of this Torah portion. If you read chapter the latter, well, but the latter from verse about 8 or so of chapter 12 through verse 4 of chapter 13, you notice there's a Kaisic structure built in. A Kaisic structure, of course, is designed to get your attention to a particular theme or event. A Kaisic structure, C-H-A-I-S-M. Kaisic structure. So you have, we've explained this before periodically, we've learned this a number of times. The Torah and the Tanakh in general is written this way, many different chapters. This is one of them. I want to draw your attention to this particular one because it explains the story of why he was in Egypt and what happened there and why he did what he did. Because otherwise it would seem strange to us. Why you'd say, oh, she's my sister, right? Why would you do that? Well, this structure explains why he was doing that and how he used it to his advantage. So in this structure, if we get up there, oh, thank you, Jeff, appreciate it. So in verse 8 of chapter 12, it discusses information. So see, from there he went to east of Bethel, pitched his tent with the Bethel in the west, Ai in the east. He built an altar to the Lord and called on the name of the Lord. That was the event that happened in verse 8 of chapter 12. Scrolling down to the very bottom, thank you, Jeff. In the latter half of verse 3 in chapter 4, he returns where he came from. As he goes, this is chapter 13 of verse 3 and 4, to Bethel, the place between Bethel and Ai, where his tent had been earlier and where he had first built an altar, there Abram called upon the name of the Lord again. So, of verse 8 of chapter 12 and verse 4, 3 and a half and 4 of chapter 13, say essentially the same type of thing. That he went to Bethel, he built an altar, and he called on the name of the Lord. This is different than what he did at Shechem. Shechem, he thanked God, he didn't call on the name of the Lord. This is the event where he called on God's name, you invoked his name, whatever it was. Let's go back at the top, please, sir. The next step, verse 9, says, then Abram went out and continued toward the Negev, which is the south. Let's go back down again to the other, and verse 3 of chapter 13 also says silver and gold from the Negev. See, he was in the Negev. So both spots of talking about the Negev, the south of Israel. We continue on this process. Verse 10, it says, now there's a famine in the land. Now this is a different example. Abram become very wealthy in livestock and silver and gold. What is the opposite of a famine? Plenty. What did Abraham have? A lot. So he went from a famine to having a whole bunch of stuff, right? Now, these are the same topics, but they're opposites of each other. One's famine, one's everything. They're opposites, but the same topic of possessions of things. In the case of food, or in the case of livestock. Still talk about livestock. Continue on in verse number D says, then Abraham went down to Egypt. That was in the latter half of verse 10 of chapter 12. And then Also, he says that in verse 1 to 30, he went up from Egypt. So he went down to Egypt in chapter 12, went up from Egypt in chapter 13. So continue on back up here. In verse 11 to 12, he's about to enter Egypt. He said to his wife, Sarai. Now, he's addressing his people. Sarai is his main people. Come back down to the bottom of it. As Pharaoh gave orders about Abram to his people. So Abraham addresses his people, which is Sarah. And, of course, Lot had to agree with this. Because he's not going to say, Sarah, tell her you're my sister. And the Lot says, no, that's not true. Lot's going to have to agree with Abraham's decision. The whole group, we all tell everybody, all the servants, oh, yeah, she's his sister. Because they all have to investigate. So everybody's got to know, Abraham, everybody knows the story, you're all on the same page. You're all telling everybody, Sarah is Abraham's sister. You got that? Yes, Larry. She was his sister, right. He didn't truly lie. He didn't give the full information, which is still not fair. Let's continue back up again. With Egyptian, they will say, this is his wife. This is verse 12 to 12. This is his wife. And they will kill me, but let you live. Now go back down again. Pharaoh's saying, here is your wife. Take her and go. So, yes, they'll say, this is his wife. Pharaoh said, here, this is your wife. And kill him, but let her live. Now, Pharaoh didn't kill Abraham, but he let her live. So Abraham's instructions to Sarah, Pharaoh still obeyed them, but he didn't actually kill Abram in the process. But the topic's the same. Let's see. In verse 13 to 12, it says, say, you are my sister. Let's go back down. Pharaoh asked him, why did you say she is my sister? They're both about the same topics of the fact that she is his sister. Let's get you back again. Let's see. When Abraham came to Egypt, the Egyptians saw that she was very beautiful. But Pharaoh's officials saw her, and they praised her to Pharaoh, and she was taken into Pharaoh's household. Now, this we're discussing Pharaoh's household, her being in Pharaoh's household. In chapter 17, verse 17, it says, the Lord inflicted serious disease on Pharaoh's household because Abram's wife Sarah was there. So both topics are Sarah being brought into Pharaoh's household. One is because she was beautiful. He thought she really wanted her. And next one, he's brought into household and he's cursed because of her. Again, it's all about Pharaoh's household and the response. Here is your center. Verse 16. The center of this structure, which explains most of the Torah portion, he treated Abram well for her sake. Abram acquired sheep and cattle, male and female donkeys, male and female servants, and camels. That means this set Torah portion of this section for chapter 12 and 13, it wants you to think about this one topic. He, referring to Pharaoh, treating Abraham well for Sarah's sake, Abram acquired sheep, cattle, male and female donkeys, female servants. He became very wealthy. Why would that be so important? Her question. How did Pharaoh know that he was being punished because of Sarah being in his household? It doesn't explain how he knew. There are a lot of theories, lots and lots of theories. Doesn't explain how he knew it. Most have argued that whatever the moment which she was brought in to his household, much like Abimelech, which they couldn't physically have relations, and other problems may have occurred too with Abimelech, which happens later on a few chapters from now, that Pharaoh probably experienced a similar type of event. That when she's brought in, God's going to prevent him from physically knowing her. Whatever that entails. Whether it is you can't pee and poop, whatever God did, it inflicted a great plague upon him such that it was destroying his household. And he kicked her and Abram out. Not out of his household, out of his country. Get out. Whatever problem arose to him and his household was so severe, he said, get out of my country. Don't come back. That's the key important response, which would explain why Abram did this. Yes, David.
The word or the phrasing that when you have these parallel verses with us.
A chiastic structure.
Can you spell that?
I'll write it out for you.
Thank you.
That's a Greek word. This is English writing down. So chaistic. Chaistic. That is the category. Chaistic. Chaistic. Oh. I knew that. I can spell. A-I-A. This a single that's a kaisum is a category. A kaisum is they just dropped the TIC in, but an ism, which is means the entire group of writing styles that includes this category. That is a Greek term for it. A Hebrew term, they probably have one because they're the ones who discovered it. So I really don't know. They're the ones who wrote it down and told everybody about it. And they probably have a name for it. I don't know what the name is. So I'm not sure. I can't. I couldn't tell you. Chiastic. Yeah, an act of making it. Yeah, a chiasm. It's a process which you write. It's a writing style, which is what was done. That's what this style is. Now, I want to explain to you, in this example, we have this explanation here as why would God want to bring this to our attention? Yeah, he gained a bunch of stuff, right? It's just stuff. Who cares, right? What does it matter? Well, God did it on purpose. Get us our attention because this one phrase should set our minds into a state of being as we're continuing to read Abram and Sarah's story. Think about what this phrase means and how God's using it and how it affects Abram and the rest of the storyline. That was the chapter 12, verse 16. That phrase, that center of the kaisic structure. What does it do? Well, following this event with this thought in process that Abram was treated well for his sake, acquired sheep, cattle, maintained little donkeys, all this stuff, it leads us straight into Lot and him having to separate. Well, why are they separating? Because Abraham grew abundantly wealthy and they couldn't fit together in the space they were hanging out at. All right. Next, also portion of it. Why did Lot choose the lush green valley versus Abraham? Then Lot didn't choose. Abraham said the other areas. Again, that story, that thought process of Abraham is abundantly wealthy is the reason why this is set this way and the story is set this way. Why did... He did get him back. He did. He got them all back. You're talking about Lot?
No, Pharaoh gave all that to...
To Abraham, yes. Right.
So why did Abraham give all that back?
Oh, this was... No, Abraham... This was not a... These items were not in payment for Sarah. They were... He was treated well because of her. So any deals that he may have made, any business dealings, it was... Favor was given to him. The nature is the nature of favor. I'll explain why, because it tells you here in chapter 15 why. But it also tells you in the book of Exodus why Abraham did not give any of the supplies back. This story of Abraham in this one section of the kaisic structure is the same blueprint that God used for the Exodus story. It's a match. They correspond to each other on purpose. When the slaves came out of Egypt, why didn't they give all the stuff back? That was payment. It was payment for all the slaves they were in. So when Abraham leaves Egypt, why didn't get all this? Why didn't he bring all the stuff back? It was payment, the fact that Sarah was in Pharaoh's house that whole time. It is his due right. It is his.
How long was she there?
It doesn't say how long. It could be a year, it could be months, I don't know. Yes. Don.
Just to clarify, when you said a little bit earlier, when Abraham was going into Egypt, you referred, I think, to when you used the term Abraham or Abram.
It's Abram, sorry.
So, that's okay.
Yeah.
But that was actually a generic term for the entire body of Abraham's people, too?
It is used as a symbolism, yes, later on. Because in Exodus explains that's how he's using it. Because all the descendants of Abraham, in chapter 15, talks about the gods for 400 years, all this stuff. The same event that Abram and Sarah go through is repeated in the story of the book of Exodus. How they got, later, why'd they go back down into Egypt? Because of a great famine. Why'd Abram go? Because of a great famine. Why, when they were in Egypt, when Jacob came to Egypt, all of a sudden came to Egypt, what did they do? Well, they got the best land all under Pharaoh's control. They were under Pharaoh's household. What happened to Sarah when she went in? Under Pharaoh's household. She gave preferred treatment. Her because she was beautiful, but the descendants of Jacob because of what Joseph had done. Joseph was a good looking man too for the same reasons, but it was how he saved Egypt. So they got the same special treatment into Pharaoh's household, a tax-free zone, which was nice. I'm sure Egyptian taxes were pretty high. So he had a special treatment area. So all these, they got treated the same way. While they were in Egypt, when Sarah was in Egypt, she was, however, separated from her love, her husband. While when Israel was in Egypt as a slave to Pharaoh, they were separated from God. What I want to get your attention is, in this Kaitic structure, it introduced and ended with one phrase. He called on the name of the Lord. Abram did that. That's the Kaitic structure. When the Israelite slaves, when they got out of Egypt, what did they do? Before they got out, they cried out to the Lord. They used the same technique Abram did to get out of Egypt. They used it the same way, calling on the name of the Lord and getting his attention. So we see the same type of events in Abram's story as the Exodus story. They're mirror images. They're blueprints of each other. God used Abraham's story of how he got in Egypt and how he got out, and used and repeated it for the Exodus story, how they got in, how they got out. There's a fundamental belief system when it comes to the Bible, right? That it's prophetic. The nature of things that are in there will happen or are used for future events. Well, here's an example. Abram's story, Abram-Sarah's story, is used again in the Exodus story. Now, in the Exodus story, they had Pharaoh's household, through Moses, was got a great abundance of plagues. Lots of them. 10 plagues, right? Well, in this story, what did Pharaoh's household go through? A whole bunch of plagues. In the Exodus story, what Pharaoh finally say? Get out! Go away! Get out of my country! Go away! And what did he tell Abram and Sarah? Escorted them out of the country to get out, and they never came back. So both stories, Pharaoh treated the people the same way as far as getting rid of you. You are a danger to me and to my household. This is not, I don't want you anymore. Both in the same way. So it's a blueprint to design. Abram, of course, gets an abundance of wealth coming out of Egypt for his turn. Israel gets also an abundance of wealth because they plundered Egypt for their turn coming out. The stories are pretty much the exact same way. Abraham never returned. Israel didn't return because the Red Sea stopped them from being able to return. The same symbolism, same blueprint, same story. Make sense? Yes.
Well, it's their punishment for being enslaved. I mean...
Say it louder and hear that.
It's, you know, Pharaoh's punishment, right? I mean, he put them in slavery and they got
the whole
looted
process. Yep. Yeah, he took them and literally took them under his control to oppress them. Well, in this, I don't know about you, but if me and my wife were separated with no option of seeing each other, she was oppressed and somebody else, I would feel oppressed. I want her back. She's mine. She's part of me. She's half of my existence is her. Well, Sarah and Abraham probably felt pretty similarly that he knew his wife was separated, having no knowledge of what was happening to her. That's oppressive. That's heart-wrenching to be in. So he was probably pretty distraught at the same time. I don't know. Well, as far as that, Israel, how long was Abram in Egypt? I don't know. Long enough to have problems for Pharaoh's household. I don't know how quickly they would have realized it. Few hours or a few weeks, I don't know, but something that he realized, I can't handle this, we have to fix this problem. But he gained a lot of wealth the process of getting there.
how long was the plague in Egypt?
Before
the Exodus.
The Exodus, the plagues?
That time period.
It was less than a year.
So I would just fathom that it's probably pretty close to that.
It very well could be. Yes.
Who he thought was Abraham's
sister.
And if I understand the traditions at that time to when a king was going to take on a new spouse or a woman, she'd have to go through a whole period of a lengthy time of cleansing.
Cleansing.
The whole shot, yeah.
It didn't have to be a year. It could be a number of months. Depends on which culture dictated. And that's derived from the events for Esther. Right. That's derived from that philosophy as far as how long the process went. I do not know if she went through multiple months, but the Exodus, the plagues and plagues, the Exodus, that happened all within less than a year. We know that because it tells us how old Moses was when he came back out, and how, when he went in and when he came back out again, it was all within 1 year's span, because he didn't gain in age. Well, if he didn't gain an age, I mean, the whole event of Exodus had to happen within a year's time because he still had to be 80 years old. So, you know, so Exodus was less than a year than Abram could have been also less than a year. I don't know. It depends on how long a famine lasts. Possibly. Let's continue on. Knowing this event, so now we know that Abram's wealthy, has a bunch of stuff. Lot and him, their herds, have issues. Now, it doesn't say that Abram and Lot fought, but so much as the herds themselves, or the cattlemen fought, or they had problems with each other. Now, they went back, thank you, Jeff. They went back, and they left Egypt, back to the Bethel area, this Bethel and Ai territory where they came from. So, Abram and Lot are hanging out here. By the way, the Salt Sea doesn't exist yet. It's just a valley, a green valley with a bunch of pits and holes and things in it. There's still water flowing into it. It's not salty yet. So they're hanging out in this territory. They're having problems. And what does Lot then do when they say, okay, you choose one, I'll choose the other. Just make your choice first. What's Lot do? His first choice is he looks out and sees all this valley. Now, they're up here because he looks all the way to the Zoar. Zoar is way down here. He's looking through many, many, many miles. Stretching and sees that it's all nice and green. Deborah had pointed out, when we make a choice and we see a nice green valley and how easy the grass is always greener philosophy, we know that story. It is not unheard of or unknown, the reputation of Sodom and Gomorrah at this time. Now, at Abraham and Lot's time, when they're making the separation ways, Sodom and Gomorrah were not a pleasant town. It wasn't a pleasant city. They would have known about it. They'd have known about it. Abram would have known about it. Everyone would know about it. When Lot chose the nice green valley, what was in the nice green valley with it? Sodom and Gomorrah and the other towns were similar. So they would have known. They would have been there for a period of time, at least a year or 2 years before this whole process would be separated. I say that because these are herdsmen, cattlemen. They sell, they buy. They have to go into the cities. Yeah, they would sit in the cities and sell their goods and sell their services, sell their items, and acquire people and make trades. So they're going in and out of the cities for business all the time. They know the reputation of Sodom and Gomorrah because the trade routes are going right through those towns also. It's not unheard of or unaware. Yes?
Towards Sodom.
He chose
Sodom. So when you face your house towards something,
yeah.
You really see what's going on.
You know what's going on.
My neighbors see everything I do.
So the valley was nice and green. What was going through Lot's head? Don't know. But whatever. He wasn't that young. He was still old. He had a wife. He had kids. Good rock band. Whatever he was seeing, he saw the green valley. And that was the easier route. That was the cleaner choice. Even though with it comes the wickedness of the cities all around. Yes, Jeff.
It just reminds me of the scripture where it talks about that God does not look on the outside. He looks at the heart. So you look at the outside. Hey, this looks like a great place to live. Mm-hmm. But you look at the heart of the place where you're going to live.
It's wicked. It's wicked beyond understanding. Yes, Larry.
The other thing Proverbs says, bad associations corrupts good morals.
Yep.
And we think, oh, well, I can handle it. I'm strong enough.
No, you're not. No. You're right. It's exactly true, but we're not strong enough. No one handles it. If you mix black and white, you don't get white. You get gray and mix it. Intermix it. You can't mix the two together. They don't become the same. They'll maintain.
The bad always makes the good worse.
Right. Good never makes the bad right or good. So we have these scenarios when Lot's making his choice. Now, obviously, Abram let Lot make the decision where he wanted to go first. Now, Abram could have stayed in Bethel. Because Lot was choosing this area of the Salt Sea, which isn't salt at the time, was all green and valley. And they debate where Sodom and Gomorrah are. No one really knows for certain. Some argue they were somewhere down here. Some argue they were somewhere over there. Some argue they were separated far away. I don't know. It doesn't matter. They were inside this pool of water, somewhere in that general area. But they were hanging out there. They were seeing this whole territory. Lot could easily have moved his herds anywhere in here. Abraham could have happily stayed in Bethel, but he didn't. After they separated, God told Abraham to go do something. What did he tell him to do after Lot separated from him? Verse 14 of chapter 13. It says, the Lord said to Abraham, after Lot departed, raise now your eyes, look where you are, north, south, east, and west, for all the land you see, to you I will give it, and to your descendants forever. I will make your offspring as the dust of the earth, so that if one could count the dust, so your offspring too could be counted. This is verse 17 now, chapter 13. Arise, walk about the land through its length and breadth, for I will give it to you. And Abram moved his tent and came and dwelled in the plains of Mamre, which are Hebron. He built an altar to the Lord. So Abram, after Lot left, and Lot takes his money and his wealth, takes that, goes in the valley, God tells Abram, take a walk. Let's walk about. North, south, east, west, walk the territory, look around. You'll see everything. Now, Bethel is it's in a valley, but you can go up to any of the hills because Mount Gerizim and Mount Ebal are there as well. As you can see, these are, actually, they're about split here. Anyway, they're about that territory. He can set up a high and look over large areas and see it, but he has to walk the territory. So Abram's going to take a walk. How long does walk take? I don't know. A year? 6 months? How long it took? He took a walk. He didn't stay in the territory, stay area of Bethel and Ai. He wound up hanging out and saying, I'm leaving here. I'm going to hang over to Hebron. Now, Hebron is over in this generalized area. You can still oversee and overlook the valley, supposedly. I don't live there, so I don't really know for certain. But you can still see things. And when Sodom and Gomorrah go up in smoke, Abram sees it. He watches them, so he obviously can see where those two cities are. He's in a good vantage point. So God says, take a walk. So he walks around, and that's where he settles on. Now, there are others who live there as well. There are three of them, Mamre, Echol, and what's the other guy's name? I've forgotten. What's the other guy's name? Abraham's three friends. Where is it? I forgot the other guy's name. It's somewhere in here. Oh, Aner, that's right, verse 13. So those three guys, he's hanging around. As a tradesman, as a herdsman, cattleman, you have your sheep, you have your flocks, you have your herds, blah, 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 all the stuff you've got. If you're out in the roadside all by yourself, what are you susceptible to? Robbers, bandits. So what's the wisest choice? Don't be alone. So when he goes to Hebron, he must have met up with those three men and said, okay, we have our stuff, we have our men, we have our people, we'll hang out together so we can defend ourselves from bandits and robbers who want to steal or hurt us or cause harm. So that, again, as it says, it bands together. So in this banding together, now this debatable as far as how the timing of this worked. This is how I personally read it. On chapter 14, the War of the Kings. So it says they were oppressed. There was a war. Starts out, there's a war. Shlodomar, all these men, these five kings come up, and they conquer the other four kings, so that territory. And they serve, verse 14, verse 4 of chapter 14, 12 years they served Shlodomar, and they rebelled 13 years. Some argue that was in the 13th year. I don't. I think at least the 13th year. I think they had 12 years of service, shipping stuff back, and then they rebelled. For 13 straight years of rebellion, they did not no longer sent things back to the territory of Shinar. That's my opinion. And the 14th year, those kings finally came back to conquer or destroy them. That's my opinion. The five kings, it was Sodom. Yes, was among them. The Sodoms were among the people who were rebelling. Not the people they're rebelling against, but the ones who were grouping together and says, we're not going to obey this other king who's so far away, and why would he care? I say it's probably 13 years because it takes a very long time for word of mouth or information to get from one spot all the way back and find out, oh, they didn't send a caravan this year. Uh-oh, quick, let's go raise an army. We don't raise an army in a few days. It takes a long time to gather army and gather utensils, the whole works required for gathering food, to make your army travel the whole distance back again without dying of dysentery and everything else they're going to have. So it takes years to build that up. So in my opinion, they probably rallied for a long period of time, 13 years, but as it says, and the 14th year is when they actually finally arrived to conquer. Now, it doesn't specify what year this fight took place. But Abram showed up sometime during the rebelling years. Because Ishmael isn't alive yet, and Ishmael's 13 years old, and Abraham's 86. And so during the rebellion years when Abraham came to Sodom and Gomorrah in that general territory of Canaan, I don't know if that was the same year God called him, I don't know, but that rebellion took place that time. So these five kings versus the four kings, they fight. The Salt Sea was not Salt Sea at the time. You have this is a Bitumen pits and various pockets of holes or tar and whatever else they got going inside them. I don't know all the details of Bitumen, but it is an ideal place if you want the strategic advantage for your enemies to fight in. Because if you want to win, you know where all the pits are. Your enemy doesn't. Theory is, they go to battle and they get caught. And you can go off and kill them. What happened? It backfired. Sodom, the king of Sodom, the king of Gomorrah, both got caught in the pits. They're the ones, presumably died, because it says they fell, they fell there, which implies they died there. They were killed. And of course, all the people themselves all ran to the mountains. So the people of Sodom and Gomorrah and the other four kings, or five, all ran to the hills. Zoar was included, so it was way down here. I don't know where along the valley it took place, but somewhere in the valley this fight took place, they broke off. Abram gets word, he gets his 318 men together, which combines not just his household, but also the other three men who are with him. They all put their servants in, they all go together to go attack and fight. Now, since it goes as far as Dan, this map has Dan up further up higher. There, Dan. So mind you, they were in Hebron territory. They pursued them and reached them as far as Dan, which is way up here. Now, that's the city of Dan. It doesn't say whether it's referring to the city or the territory. The territory of Dan was bigger. It covered a larger area. It could have been the whole region referring to Dan. It doesn't specify. But either way, it goes up there, and they stop them or end them at north of Damascus, which today... Was Rabbah Damascus, the old name of Damascus? I can't remember. Maybe it is over here. It might show up on this map. At least Rabbah was Damascus. These towns got renamed. I believe Rabbah is Damascus today. I could be off on that, but I'll double check. Either way, this general territory is where he stopped, north end of Damascus, that generalized area. I can't see Damascus on the map. Where is it? Oh, there it is. Thank you. That's Damascus. It was somewhere. Okay. So they went up to this area. So they went to Dan and they stopped north of Damascus in that area. That's good. Thank you. I didn't catch that. I couldn't find Damascus on there. That's where he stopped and went back home. This is where our explanation of the five kings versus four kings come in. Why is that there? What's the point of that battle? It's not so much the names. It's the actions of the kings. I mentioned before, when you're looking through a Torah portion, remind yourself there are two ways. There's God's way, and then there's man's way. And usually they aren't the same. When Abram comes back from his fight, what happens? Who comes out to greet him? Two kings come out to greet him. Sodom. And who's the second king that comes out to visit him? Melchizedek, yeah. I'll misspell his name. Can't be close. It's probably a terrible misspelling. I don't know how to spell the guy's name. It's a long one. So two kings came to visit him at the same time. They both come to greet him. This isn't an event sequential event. This is both the same time. So Sodom comes and visits him, and Melchizedek comes and visits him. Now Melchizedek says king of Salem, they believe it's king of Jerusalem. That would mean he's a Jebusite. I don't really know which town precisely is his. It doesn't make any difference. The point is, look at what the kings do. Because mind you, Abraham's a man of faith. Faith means I listen to and I do it. I trust it and I will follow it. I trust God. And so my actions, as James points out, My faith is shown by the way I live my life, the way I act and do my things, how I do things. That's how your faith is based on. So let's look at the faith of Sodom and the faith of Melchizedek. What do these two men do? What's Sodom's first response? He wants stuff and he wants to give things. Sodom asks for people. And mind you, if you are a king, where does your strength come from?
People.
It's not possessions. It's people. I can be a king of the dirt I'm standing on. Does the dirt care? No. If I'm a king of a bunch of people, do people care? Yes. Because I can oppress them or I can do things for them or benefit, whatever. So people is what makes a king. Not the dirt or the money. It's the people. So he wants people, but he offers, what does he offer? Actually, we'll get the offer in a minute. Well, I should have known. Stuff. It's possessions. He offers... two F's? Yeah. Offers possessions of what of the livestock. Yeah. Livestock, which includes money as well. And any weapons he may have gathered during the fight, the battle that he took, any other things of value. Valuable items, valued items. He offers those, but he wants to keep the people. What does Melchizedek offer?
Bread.
Wine. And a blessing. Melchizedek. Yeah, it's Melchizedek. It's a lot of ways you pronounce the guy's name. Mel. Whatever. Terrible spelling. So this is what he offers. What does he get in return? What does Melchizedek get in return? Melchizedek receives a tenth. Tenth of the spoils. We call it spoils. Now, two kings come to you. One offers you an abundance of wealth. Says, here, take all of this. You can have it all. You earned it. It's all yours. And the burden of all the people to take care of them, wipe their bottoms, do the whole works, I'll take care of that. That's Sodom. And then there's the king of Melchizedek says, here's some bread, here's some wine, here's a blessing. And now you give me a tenth of all the good stuff you just got. Of these two kings who approach you, what does our human instinct say?
Take all the stuff.
Take all the stuff. What does Abram do? He took this instead. Yeah. He valued this greater than all this. Different king. Sodom's multiple kings. So you have a son, or dad, he dies, son comes over. It's a generational thing. So it doesn't have to be this particular king that died the tar pit. It can be the next generation, the one who's still alive or still who becomes in charge afterward. It doesn't make a lot of difference which one it is. The successor. So he offers two different things, two different responses. Now again, remind you, Abraham just dealt with Lot not too long ago. And with Lot had to choose the valley that was pretty with all the wickedness in it. So Abraham knows what wickedness is and he's dealt with Sodom over the years of business. And what is his reason why he does not choose Sodom's gift? Right, Sodom made him rich. Because all this stuff makes you rich. What did Satan offer the Messiah?
Everything.
Everything. Now, was it Satan's to offer?
Yeah.
Yes, it was. The world, our world around us, it's very heavily ruled by him. He does a good job of that. Doing his own will. So it was Satan's to give. What's Messiah's response? No, I won't touch it. I won't take it. It's not mine. You do not tempt the Lord your God. All those stuff that he goes through with the three different trials he goes through. So Messiah and Abram have a similar viewpoint of life. There is true value, and then there's the stuff. Yes, Don.
Lot, his nephew, was a part of that people, so he's trying to get his Lot back also.
It could be. We don't know if Abram would have given Lot over or not. I don't know. I just don't know. Because by the time Sodom and Gomorrah shows up and Lot's trying to convince people to stop trying to rape and pillage and kill people, they say, Lot, you're a foreigner. You don't even belong here. He's been there for 20 years. and is still considered a foreigner to the people of Sodom. So I don't know how attached the king was to Lot. I would think maybe to Lot's stuff, because Lot was very wealthy, but he was offering to give all of the stuff up. So that wasn't going to be, he wasn't going to get Lot's stuff back. I don't know how, what attachment the king had to Lot. It could be he liked one of Lot's daughters. Don't know. He had at least four, we know that much, because two survived and he refers to his other daughters, plural. He may have had more than four daughters, I don't know. But he has at least four, so maybe the king liked one of them. I have no idea. But whatever he wanted the people. I don't know if Lot would even was willing to stick around. I don't know. But he's going to offer it. But we know that the personality of the Messiah and Abram are similar. They value the same types of things. Because both of them realized or knew the blessing from God was worth far more than the possessions. Not only that, he even gave a bunch of them to the guy. So you can have it. So we realize we see the picture of what type of trials Abraham's going through and how Messiah's going through a similar type of trial and how Abraham discerns who to choose and who to go with, what to do and what not to do. Abraham was a smart man. He doesn't make a lot of mistakes. Yes.
It says that Melchizedek blessed him.
Yes.
What exactly does that mean or entail? What is a high priest blessing Abraham?
That's a really good question. I don't know what he said. Yeah, I don't know what words. Yeah, blessing upon you. Other than the phrase here that says he blessed him, the name of God Most High, there's a lot of Jewish philosophies as well as what he said and what he effectively did. Their belief system in the Jewish, when they read this, the non-Messianic believers, is just straight Orthodox Jewish beliefs. Is that Melchizedek was blessing him with a priesthood. That he was taking his righteousness, because he was righteous before God, and the Psalm says that, and was giving the blessing of to Abraham. Because they believe Melchizedek was actually Shem, the son of Noah. Not their right or wrong. That's their belief system. But they're taking this promise, the promise that God gave to Noah, and transferring it through this blessing to Abraham, that he would now continue on the promise that God gave to Noah. That's their philosophy. And it's not that wrong. That's actually a fair assessment. Because the promise, one that came through Abraham's line. So it's a correct association that they're seeing, they're following through. Whether or not he did more than just that is a matter of debate. But Melchizedek, we don't know a lot about him. I know there's a lot of philosophies the New Testament talks about. You know history, know family line, know where he came from, all that kind of stuff. That doesn't mean the man didn't actually physically exist. It means that there's no record of him. They were using a symbolic way of which what Melchizedek represented. What did he symbolize? He symbolized one who could give a blessing from God. Nobody else could, but he could. So God would listen to his words and adhere to or listen to and follow the blessing he's giving. That's the idea behind him. And of course, what did Abram then receive? That blessing. He received what Melchizedek gave to him. The blessing that he is blessed with God Most High. And was Abraham blessed from the God Most High? Yes, he was. Abraham then used the same phrase that Melchizedek said, rebuking Sodom. Swearing to the God Most High that he wouldn't touch from a shoestring to a thread. I mean, that belonged to him. So Abraham then, that implies Abraham is then accepting or acknowledging the blessing Melchizedek's giving him, that God Most High is now yours, Abraham. Abraham saying, yes, he is mine, and I will now use him and use him as my witness that I will do what is right versus what is not right. Does that make sense?
Yes, absolutely.
Yeah.
Any commentary or thought on perhaps the blessing going beyond that into almost a baptismal or I don't know if there's anything there or not. It's just interesting that he goes to battle and, you know, there's death and war and then he goes on to, you know what I mean? And at that point meets a high priest who would, you know, offer him forgiveness for those acts, bless him.
Right.
You know what I mean?
That's a good point. I don't know. I haven't read specific things about that topic. Specifically, so I don't know. There might be some more thought out theories or explanations as far as what was going on. I know there's a lot of history that I don't know to expel to call upon in that way. So I don't know. Maybe there was more to it than what we see. I don't know. Louise.
All right. Yeshua does not come through the line of King of Sodom, but he does come through the line of Abraham.
Yes.
So that, yes. That it's like God is protecting the line for Jesus to come.
Right. To do what is right. It's the right line, which was good. Let's see here. Let's jump through this a little bit. A little bit behind time, but I'll catch up. I just started late. That's fair. Okay. Let's see here. All right. Now let's go to the next section, which talks about chapter 15 and 16, as far as the promise of a child and how that was going to work out and inheritance and all that kind of good stuff. So a few details here. There's not a great amount of information. Verse 15, I'll point something out to you in verse 6, I think it is. Yeah, verse 6. It says, this is Abraham and God are having a conversation through a vision. And God's pointing out to him that, this is chapter 15, that Abraham's pointing out to God that I have no children, there's obviously no descendants to inherit any of the offspring, any stuff that I have, yada, yada, yada. God says, no, your offspring will come through your body, this is how it will happen. And verse 6, and he, referring to Abram, trusted in the Lord, and he, referring to the Lord, reckoned to him as righteousness. So Abraham's trust is explained here. Trust is how you get your righteousness in God's eyes. What is trust? Well, wholehearted belief and dependency. You know, not through sight, not through action, not through what you've observed, but you know intuitively from God that this will happen, and it will happen this way, however God worded it. So hence we get this idea of faith. As a descendant of Abraham through faith, our trust in God. Here's where our interesting story comes up of the method by which he chooses to make this happen. We're not going to go through all the story of the splitting of the animals, because that's a separate topic I want to cover today. Verse chapter 16. What happened? Chapter 16, what happens? The storyline of how Abraham and this whole promise that God offered to him, what happens next?
He ends up with Hagar.
Yep. Sarai offers him Hagar. Now, New Testament discusses this quite in length. That this idea of Hagar being the woman of the flesh versus woman of the spirit, and discuss the different ideas of woman of the promise, son of the promise for children with Isaac, and of course Hagar's child Ishmael, the children of the flesh, and divides them out. So they were supposed to be children of the flesh through Ishmael and Hagar, children of the spirit, the promise through Isaac, and of course his descendancies. So in this storyline where Sarai does this, we may critique her and say that was a bad choice. Reality is, God used it. He used it. I mentioned before many times, God doesn't make mistakes. Things happen, and he knows about them, and it's with his blessing that they occur. If he says, hey, that's not going to happen, what happens? It doesn't happen. If he says, yeah, that's going to happen, then what occurs? That happens. So this story is not foreign to him. It's not shocking to God. So in this story, which you have your two splits of Ishmael and soon to be, which we'll read soon, Isaac. That was purposeful. That was intended. Why would God intend that? Right? There's wars and they kill each other and they hate each other and hate and hate and hate and hate and hate. It's supposed to be that way. Because flesh, well, does it inherit it? It's supposed to be at war with your spirit. There's supposed to be a war. They're supposed to be always hating each other, always at each other's throats, not tolerating each other's existence. They're supposed to be that way. What does it tell us? Well, what does it teach us to be? always at war with the same thing. Our own idea of flesh, our own ways, our ways versus God's ways, they are not mutually compatible. They're exclusive. They don't like each other. This fight happening was on purpose. It's always supposed to be that way. It's not a shock. God didn't say, oh, whoops, I made a mistake. I was blinking. I took a nap. I didn't notice. What happened? What did you do? None of that stuff. It was on purpose. It is. Because there are two ways of life. There's God's way, and then there's man's way. And they almost never agree. We've learned from Abraham, here's two ways of life. Which way did he choose? Man's way, or was it God's way? He chose God's way. Here's now two ways of life, Ishmael's way and Isaac's way. Which way do we choose? Always, folks, that the idea is there are two ways. The whole Bible is filled with two ways. You choose blessing, you choose cursing. You choose God's way, you choose man's way. Yes?
Well, I think it's also important to note that even with Ishmael, he still got his promise. He still made many descendants.
Yes, he still blessed him.
Because it was Abraham's seed, and he promised Abraham that his seed would go forth.
Exactly.
And make many descendants, even though Isaac was the spirit side of law, and maybe Ishmael was lawlessness or whatever.
You're giving details, right.
But it just shows the faithfulness and you know, of the father, that he made a covenant and he stuck by it, even though Abraham tried to, and it's still, bam.
Yep. And when we look at our flesh, and I'm a flesh and blood human being, right? I live and I die, I bleed, I'm not dead yet. Sometime later. I have a life. How do I experience life? Do I experience life through my spirit or through my flesh? Well, I experience it through my flesh. I shake people's hands. I say hello. I can see you. I can touch you. I can eat. That's how I experience life. If God is blessing my life, is he blessing my spirit? Sure. Is it blessing my flesh too?
Yes.
So it's not that the flesh doesn't get blessed. It gets blessed. But the idea of what is inheritance, what is truly mine, is different. In Ishmael's example, what was his inheritance going to be? By the way, mind you, he's the oldest son. Firstborn son by 13 years at least. What should he get?
Everything.
His flesh, they should receive everything. What does he get? Well, a whole lot less than everything. he gets secondary. What gets everything? It's Isaac that gets everything. Well, essentially everything. The dominant portion of it. So we see that the separation, the dividing between these lines, it was intentional. It wasn't by accident. God wanted it this way. It gives us a perfect example of what our own lives are like. Does that make sense? Okay. I'm going to conclude here real quick with chapter 17. So we already know that Abraham receives a blessing from God and that he would be the inheritance of all this land. Abraham, of course, argued back and forth, all right, I don't have any kids though. Eleazar is going to be my child, going to inherit my land. God says, no, it'll be from you. Then Ishmael comes along. Abraham says, hey, take Ishmael. God says, no, it has to be through Sarah, not through you, not through Hagar. It has to be through a particular person. So it's a combination. And then after he does all this, and this is your maidservant, I'll bless her, and blah, blah, blah. Chapter 17 shows up. Abraham's 99 years old, and he gets circumcised. Ouch. It says, I'm El Shaddai, verse 1 of chapter 17. Walk with me and be perfect. I'll set my covenant between me and you. I will increase you most exceedingly. Abraham said, on the face, God spoke with him, saying, as for me, this is my covenant with you. You shall be a father of a multitude of nations. Your name will not be called Abraham. Your name shall be Abraham. I made you a father of a multitude of nations. I'll make you the most exceedingly fruitful. Make nations out of you. Kings shall descend from you. I will ratify my covenant between me and you, between your offspring and after you, throughout the generations, as an everlasting covenant to be a God to you and to your offspring after you. I will give you and your offspring after you the land which of your sojourns, the land of Canaan, as an everlasting possession. So what is the covenant of circumcision for? What does it do? What's the mark here? What does it say? I'll make you a multitude of nations, everlasting covenant, to be a God to you and to your offspring after you, and I will give to you, your offspring after you, the land of your sojourns. So what's the circumcision for? That God will be your God, you will be part of him, that's the circumcision marker, and the inheritance that God promised Abraham earlier is also part of your inheritance too. That's the nature of circumcision is about. And that's what it's for, to be attached to Abraham's inheritance. What did Abraham inherit? Everything. What is everything? Explain what you think everything is.
Life.
He inherited life. What kind of life?
Eternal.
Eternal life. There's territory he landed to. Yep, from Euphrates River all the way to the Wadi of Egypt. It's a large swath of land. I realize most of it's desert land, but still, it's a large chunk of land, which Abraham had to live in desert land too. A lot of things he inherited, but the eternal life and this promise that would come one day, of which we already are familiar with as believers, when we see the Messiah, that is part of his inheritance too. So anybody who follows Abraham with that mark, whether it be a physical flesh or whether it be in your heart, that's not the point. The point is, you are attaching yourself to that same inheritance. Right? That's what it says. Poke my ear. Sorry, so the hand up. I lost it. That's all right. Sorry about that. So when we deal with circumcision, and it doesn't matter whether you're born in Abraham's house or bought with money or joined it later. So what does that mean to those of us who join after we're adults? Uncircumcised. What was that?
You
to be our God. Yep. You're God.
The land or the kingdom of the future.
Yep. You got mark it. You circumcise your the flesh, your foreskin, or the heart. Now, I do realize... Yeah, the covenant. Now, mind you, when it comes to people's arguments about, oh, well, an old man comes uncircumcised, blah, blah, we're discussing that topic. And the Bible is pretty clear on the fact that, as far as the New Testament is, that if you came uncircumcised, so be uncircumcised. If you came circumcised, you'd be circumcised. And you can't uncircumcise yourself. Well, now we can, but they couldn't then. A lot of plastic surgeries today. But you wouldn't want to it wouldn't work. But the idea is that the uncircumcised person would come, join, follow, pay attention, teach their children. When they have children, will the children become circumcised? The circumcision process is a continuous cycle. Whether somebody shows up as a purchased servant sometime later, or acquires, shows up or joins on as a later time, their descendants will then attach and be taught and follow the same process. They continue on the same line. That's the idea behind it. Yes,
now Deborah. I remember. Okay, so it says to you and your descendants, if we follow, that means our family members, right? Me and my family. So maybe I'm the head of my family. Like, perhaps.
Yeah, you could. Yes, I mean,
it's an umbrella
fair.
Folding. Like my son. Maybe they're
up
not
to
walking.
A point. Your descendants, as far as the Torah is concerned, when your children be each the age of 20.
Oh, but
they stand on
mature.
Their own 2 feet.
Right. So if they're 20 years old and they aren't.
That's their own 2 feet. They stand on their own 2 feet before God.
So I got priest pray for Eric. Not your baby.
Because it points out when they came out of Egypt, God said, every male 20 and older, you're all going to die in the wilderness for 40 years. Because you are responsible for your decision of saying, I don't want the land, it's too dangerous, the giants are too big, blah, blah, blah. You can't trust God. That's the, God marked it, 20 years and up. You stand on your own 2 feet. Little children, 5-year-olds, 10-year-olds, they don't stand on their own 2 feet. They stand on their parents' 2 feet to say, hey, that's what I taught my child, he's following, blah, blah, blah. Does that make sense? So yeah, there is a point in time which your children are under your care and a point in time which they're not. They have to stand on their own 2 feet. Where was I? Oh, right, circumcision. Okay, thank you. This is a mark. It's a mark to indicate that you will attach or you attach yourself to God. You attach yourself to the philosophy, the beliefs that God has instructed. That's a good thing. Now, we read the Galatians about circumcision. Oh, well, the circumcised versus uncircumcised, yada, yada, go back and forth, back and forth, back and forth. Well, it's pretty simple. That's how I view it. You may disagree, and that's fine. Somebody who is choosing to be circumcised, let's say a grown adult, I'm choosing to be circumcised physically. You are choosing to say, all right, the entire Torah, just like every other circumcised person, I will live like you do. I will obey the instructions as it's permitted, as it's instructed. Because the Torah has laws for uncircumcised people, what they can and can't do, what they must and must not do. They have their sets. If you wish to be circumcised, you are choosing, okay, this is the law for the uncircumcised. I am choosing the other set over here, which all the Israelites follow. There's nothing evil or better about one or the other. They're distinctly different, but they're just different. It's okay to be part of one group and say, well, I wish to be part of the other group instead, and choose to be circumcised in the place you'll live like all the apostles lived. Guess which one of them was not circumcised? All of them got circumcised. The apostles, there's 12. And yes, they all got circumcised. So all of them got circumcised. There's nobody who wasn't circumcised. They all were. So what did they choose? By their choice, they're saying, I wish to say, here is the Torah that the Messiah followed and all the Jews who have followed, Israelites have followed, that these laws will apply to me. As opposed to an uncircumcised, no, I will choose the ones which I know I can do, and I will stick with those, so that's where God has put me. It's fine. You choose what you, it's okay. Whichever one you choose is what you choose. That's what you're going to stick with. You may progress on to somewhere else or not, it makes no difference. If you come one way, that's fine, stay that way, unless you choose to be otherwise. It's okay. But that's the nature of circumcision. Yes, Don, hold on.
I think I understand this, but I wanted to ask you anyway. In our day and age, children oftentimes are circumcised. What is their status? It must be intent, right?
I'm sorry. In other words,
children are circumcised. They have the slightest idea.
I have no clue what's going on.
Oh, that are not Jewish.
Right, right.
So what is their status then?
Well, once you're circumcised, you're marking it. That's the nature of the mark. So whether the child knows it or not, or was raised in a household to taught him that way or not, this is what it means. Now, when that child becomes an adult and says, hey, God willing, I now know what this means, I will then follow it. You are still under your parents' tutelage all the way through your childhood until you were an adult and you stand on your own 2 feet again. So the circumcision is not necessarily applicable, meaning it doesn't mean a whole lot to a child if the parents are teaching them something different. When they're an adult, that's when it means something. Now, us in modern day and age, I realize many people don't even care. It means nothing to them. Well, if they say nature as an uncircumcised heart, it's the same problem. It doesn't mean anything to you. It's empty. You may have been taught something when you were a child, and you threw it out when you were an adult. So you forget that. I like to do this life this way. You may have been circumcised, quote-unquote, when you were a child in your heart, but when you became an adult, you became uncircumcised. You were choosing to follow a totally different route of life. You were rejecting that mark, that inheritance, which is your right to choose. Not say it's a good choice, but it's your right to choose. Every person has that right to choose. Yes, Rose, I didn't conclude. I'm running late.
I'd just like to read what our Savior said.
Yes.
He said, whosoever therefore shall break the least of these my commandments shall teach men to do so,
yep,
he shall be called least in the kingdom of heaven. But whosoever shall do and teach them, that same shall be called great in the kingdom of heaven. So it doesn't necessarily mean that you're going to be out. It just means you're not. Your position in the kingdom is like people today who go to church on Sunday or, you know, they love the Lord, but they don't keep the holy days.
Right. They
may not get kicked out, but their position will be very low.
As we discussed many times, you're absolutely right. The laws of God are not salvation issues. They're life issues. They're life decision makers. Salvation's a gift. You don't work for it. It's given to you. That's not the question. It's how do you live? What do you do with it? Are you going to live your life? Are you going to pursue it? Are you going to teach? Are you going to explain? Are you going to raise your children? That's how you live a life. That's where how the kingdom of God instructs you and how God teaches us. How many of us learn through the life that we live? We all do. God uses our lives to teach us, doesn't he? So that's a way in which you live. Those are the instructions here. How do you live? If you're not sure? Well, read it. Explain how you deal with this particular situation or that one. That's how we do these things. That's a way of life. The salvation is a different topic. That's a gift given to you for believing in the Messiah. That's a different issue. You're right. He didn't say you won't be there. You will be there. It's What condition you're in? What are you going to do there? Did you learn something while you were alive, or did you do nothing while you were alive? If you didn't do anything, don't expect to be the guy on top, commanding and instructing millions of people or millions of spirits. You'll be instructed, but not necessarily the instructor. There's a difference of what you know versus what you don't know. Yes, Larry.
Well, I think we have to, you alluded to it, but I think we have to go about what Apostle Paul said, that circumcision is not of the flesh, but it is of the heart.
Right.
And so we have to, that has to be in there someplace, whether, because for at least non-Jewish people, if not, of course, there's no Jew nor Greek either.
Right, so, right, right. No difference.
So we've got to think about that in this topic, about what it really means is the way we act towards God.
And toward man, and toward people too.
Well,
yes. Part, yeah. Yes. That's to love your Lord your God with your heart, mind, soul, and your spirit, right? That's the nature of heaven. Well, how do you do those things? Well, God tells us how.
So we're left with our when we were young and we had our child, our boy child, the society said that this was not a good thing to do because
right.
It caused problems.
Yeah,
for,
all the issues, complaints, right.
And in fact, when they did it in those days, it was very dangerous. They could die of infection easily.
Mm-hmm.
But so we didn't circumcise our son. So mm-hmm. Now what does that mean? Well, he is a believer,
mm-hmm.
And it's up to him to decide what he wants to do about that.
What that is.
But he should be able to decide not to do it without having to worry about any repercussions.
There isn't any. In the instruction which the Apostle Paul gives us, it points out that if you circumcise, the whole law is now upon you, which is fine. Because the whole law was on Apostle Paul too. Did he die? He lived through it. He lived it. So if you choose to be circumcised, you're expected with the whole, you're choosing as an adult, I choose this, you're choosing to live like the apostles lived, like Messiah lived. You're choosing that life. Now, most of us don't live the way they lived. I'm not even half as a Torah observant as those men were. I try to be, but I'm just not. I'm just not that good at it. I'm working on it. So, thank you. So we already know that, all right, when you make this decision, you're choosing to say, I wish to live like you did or do, Apostle Paul or Apostle Peter. Live the way, with the laws that you understand how you live. I'm not saying for your particular son, but how many children or people may say, okay, that's too much for me. I don't want
to
do that.
We're trying to get our
Yeah, that's too much for me. It might be too much for you. Well, just the laws themselves may be too much for you. Okay, if the laws themselves are too much for you, then don't do them, because you're just going to fail at it. If they're too much for you, don't do them. Don't take on that burden. It's not proper. It's not fitting for you. Well, if it isn't too much for you, say, no, I'm going to make this commitment, I'm going to do it, then that's a different position. You should have a different yoke you wish to put on. That's fine. The Didache, which explains a lot of this, it talks about the instructions for us people who are circumcised versus uncircumcised. So you uncircumcised come in, you don't know much of anything. You're just learning. Do what you can as the instruction. Do what you're able to do. If you're able to go beyond and go through the whole process, that's your decision. It's fine. But do what you're able to. Don't try to do what you're not able to do. It wouldn't work. You'd fail it.
We trust him. He says, do these things and you will figure it. You will find out.
You'll find out.
Why.
Yeah.
I don't know why.
You just do them. You learn. Yes.
So, the guys have to do all this stuff, but us women don't have to do any of that stuff. So what's
the big deal? Yes, you do. Sorry. I'm not referring to the sixers.
I didn't get to finish.
Oh, go ahead.
Okay. So, if the men are doing all this circumcision stuff, and they're doing all this other stuff, but us women do it without having to go through circumcision and all this stuff, and we're obeying the Torah, and we're doing what's required, but as far as I know, we don't get circumcised.
No.
We don't get any of that stuff. I don't want it. I'm saying, but we are obedient to what God says.
Yes.
So I don't understand why the men have to do all this stuff, but we still do everything without having to have all this stuff put on us. Am I saying that right?
Yeah, okay. I think if I understand what you're saying, I believe so. I'll try to explain a little briefly because I'm out of time. When God made Adam and Eve, right, there was a philosophy behind it. And that she would pursue or follow his instruction, his lead. All right, because that's the whole nature of, okay, God gave Adam all the instruction what to do. And then he made Eve. Okay, the idea is that he would instruct and teach Eve. The Torah also leads to the same idea. When there's a war, wrong marker. In a war, you capture some lady who's not known a man, unmarried, blah, blah, blah. You choose to marry her. So a marriage. Okay, different marker. Third time's a charm, right? Okay. What is the instruction for marriage? Well, you got 30 days of mourning for her parents. She's in your household. After that time period's done, then the marriage happens. Why would God do that? Thank you, William. Why would God do that? Because what's the woman's responsibility? Raise children. That was the instruction given to Eve. This curse is on you, and you fulfill the curse. When you've completed, you have given birth. That's her job. How is she going to raise the children? In Torah. Why would you say that? Because, who's her husband? Her husband's her husband. So through that war, the man, assuming he's a man who's following God, his job is, okay, I found a wife I want, we're going to have kids, and what's her responsibility? Raise the kids according to my family's instruction, not her family's instruction. The woman's designed to attach herself to her husband. That's what it's for. And that, okay, husband, what is your instruction? How do you want to live? How do you want the homeless set? But how do you want our children to exist? What way of life? What inheritance are you giving them? Because, mind you, inheritance is through the man. What is inheritance? God. So if God is the inheritance, he wants his wife to fall. Teach my children to get the same inheritance I have, which is God. Right? So the circumcision is upon him. And he's making that agreement. I'm taking this inheritance, God. I'm holding on to it. I'm receiving it. I'm going to pass on to my children through my wife, because it's the only way it's going to happen. And the wife's job is to instruct the children accordingly. Make sense? So it's not that she isn't subject to it. She is. It's her husband, through her husband, that's supposed to have the inheritance is supposed to travel through. It's a partnership. Does that make sense?
And his job is to give up his life.
Yep. Yep, he works and lives till he dies. He works for her until he dies. That's his function. Just continue to make sure this process works and she is taken care of, this process happens all the way until it becomes dirt. Make sense? Yes, David.
It seems to me that every time we get on the subject of circumcision, it goes in all directions.
It does.
And emotions come into play. And we get all this stuff, but as we all grow and come closer to the Father, and as we look at his Torah and his instructions, and we strive to become more obedient, we realize at our own pace, and everybody's different. But if somebody was to ask me if I was to be circumcised today, the point that I am in my life and faith is I would have to answer that, of course. Because...
where you are.
However, we would never tell a new believer, oh, by the way,
you got to be
before, and that was the whole argument with the circumcision party and all that.
Right.
But the bottom line is everybody has to come to that in their own terms.
Right.
And as we read through Scripture and we come to understand that that is a covenant,
mm-hmm.
and it is a requirement, and it is an act of obedience, and it is a shedding of blood, sealing that covenant.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm not sure, and only the Father knows, how he is to look upon somebody as where they are in that process of their faithfulness and obedience, if I'm making sense.
Yeah, that's
so. In his case, when he brought up his son...
Mm-hmm.
And I understand that because I was faced with those same
issues.
Same thing. And it became very strong for a very period of time. And I think it's amongst certain mindsets of people. But, that is something that people say, oh, we're not going to do that. We're not going to do that. And that's fine. And somebody could become obedient to the Father, never have reached that point in their walk.
Yep.
And of course, their salvation is true.
Yes, done.
However, I believe that, and this is just David, if you get to that point where you're looking at these things and it is part of your Torah, and you need to address that and make those choices accordingly. And we know that it has nothing to do with our salvation,
right?
But it does come in line with obedience and becoming obedient to his Torah.
Yep.
And as far as the women goes, I mean, you know, we're their head covering. We have made that covenant. And if our wife is going to be okay with the fact that we're going to whack son's peepee at 8 years old, she needs to understand what we went through and what our commitment is.
Yep, yep. The nature of a parent having to circumcise, not physically, but having going through it for their son, it shows you, as an infant, the parent is making an agreement, I will raise my son this way. I make an agreement with God. I'm going to raise the son to be this understanding and comfort. Whether the son chooses to later on in life, that's his business. But that you're going to go through a route. It's circumcision for an infant is an awful, is significantly more important to the parents than it is to the child. The parents are agreeing, I'm going to do something, I'm committed to do this. Whether or not they're circumcised or not, the fact you do it to your child, you are committing, I'm going to do and live and teach my child this way of life. Yes.
I'm sorry, and I just one last point of that is in the Western mindset, when we, you know, profess Yeshua is our Messiah, we don't understand that we're making a covenant with God, and we don't even understand what the covenant is.
Right.
It's so easy to make a covenant and then go, oh, wow, you mean I got to whack out of the way? You know what I mean? It's like we don't understand what a covenant is with our Father.
Right.
But yet we're all ready to do this because we're looking at salvation and eternity and all the goodness, but we're not looking at what is in our heart, what we have to do.
When I started out this portion early on, when Messiah gave the examples of the sand versus the rock house, right? They're both here, but only one actually does. And you hear what the rules are, you hear what God instructed to live this way, but you don't actually do it. You're not there. Not that you won't be there, but you're not there now. And that's how a lot of that plays out throughout this Torah portion and through our understanding of what this means. Doing means something.
Proclaiming Yeshua is our Messiah.
Right. As agreement, yeah.
It's not saying, "Oh, I believe Jesus."
No,
I'm saved. It's the start of a covenant,
yeah. And then it leads to where that's going to take you. Any other question, comments? I'm over time, so I apologize. Yes.
Woo!
What would you say? Christians like to say, "Shine a light in the darkness," like displace the darkness. I have written down here in my notes, man's association corrupts good morals, which makes perfect sense if you're going to go into a situation to use your judgment. But there's a lot of confusion out there. You know, they say displace the darkness. You know, you're supposed to shine a light.
Right.
Well, just one little thing on that.
Go ahead.
The Apostle Paul in Galatians 6:1 kind of puts it well. It's like, yeah, if you go in after somebody, great. But be careful when you go in, because you may get dragged in too.
Oh.
So,
as far as how you serve
Galatians 6:1 is always the warning against going in to shine your light in the darkness. But be careful.
How you do it, yeah. There's a lot, yeah. For example, I wouldn't be up here if we were in North Korea. We'd all be dead. I'd be very, very quiet, and if I speak Korean, I'd whisper only to people who I knew, because otherwise, it's not that the word of God shouldn't be proclaimed, no, it's that it will do no good if everyone who opens their mouth dies. That's a waste. Discernment and pay attention to how you're doing it, and make sure you're working within the overheading blackness above you to be careful that it doesn't touch you. And be careful how you're doing things. It's called wisdom and discernment. Pay attention to what you're doing and how it's doing it. And it is always wise, in my opinion, why Messiah said, go in pairs of two. Because there's always somebody else saying, you know what? Let's walk over here, buddy. You're getting a little bit too close to that. Have somebody with you. He wasn't foolish. He knew what he was talking about. Go in pairs. Because you're going to need somebody else to say, okay, are we still stable? Are we on sand now? I didn't notice. That's a dangerous area to live. Make sense? Okay. Let's conclude with a prayer. Almighty God, our great Father, thank you for the Shabbat, a day of rest, and a day of learning and teaching and following your ways. We ask you to bless us and hear our prayers and grant us peace. Bless the rest of our Shabbat, Father, that we fellowship with one another and learn what is right in your eyes, to share our lives with each other as a community, as friends, as family. We trust you and ask your blessing to lead us well and help us to follow you wherever that leads. In Yeshua's name, amen. Amen.
You've been listening to a discussion at Hallel Fellowship. If you would like to hear more discussions or if you have any questions, visit the website at hallel.info. That's H-A-L-L-E-L.info. Hallel.info.